Lakes. Behind the front is drier and colder air. As a result, we'll see below average temperatures through the weekend. Another weather system off the Pacific coast will bring a good chance of light snow east across Illinois and surrounding states Monday and Monday night as it moves into the Mississippi Valley. High temperatures today will range from around 10 degrees over northern Wisconsin to the mid-40s across western Kentucky. Low temperatures tonight will range from the single digits below zero in northern Wisconsin to the low 20s in southwestern Kentucky. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, cloudy. Light snow is likely with a snow accumulation of less than 1/2 inch. We'll see a high in the upper 30s early with the temperature falling through the afternoon. The wind from the west at 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts to 25 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy and cold with scattered flurries this evening. The low 15. It will be windy with a wind out of the northwest from 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts to 35. Tomorrow, sunny. Look for a high of 25. The wind from the northwest at 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts to 30. Tomorrow night, mostly clear with a low of 11. The wind will be from the northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts to 25 miles per hour. Sunday, sunny with a high in the upper 20s. The wind from the west at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Sunday night, partly cloudy with a low around 20. Monday, mostly cloudy with a chance of snow. We'll see a high in the low 30s. Monday night, snow is likely and a light accumulation of snow is possible. At noon central time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana were in the 30s. It was cloudy across the two states, with many locations reporting precipitation. At Rockford, light snow and 31. O'Hare Airport reported light snow and 34. It was 35 at Bloomington and Mattoon, and Carbondale light rain, 36 degrees there. In South Bend, 35 degrees with mixed precipitation. In Lafayette, 34. Indianapolis reported light snow and 34 degrees. In Terre Haute, light snow and 35 degrees. Willard Airport reported 35 degrees at the top of the hour, cloudy with fog. The dew point, 33. The relative humidity, 92%. The wind out of the southwest at 14 with gusts to 26. No, excuse me. The wind was out of the southwest at 14 miles per hour, giving us a wind chill of 26 degrees. My scribbles caught up with me here this afternoon. And the barometric pressure, 29.96 and falling. At 12:40, 34 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. Greek politicians agreed yesterday on massive cuts to bring their budgets in line with what the European Union has demanded. It's the latest act in a long drama to bring down the Greek debt load. NPR's Zoe Chase of Planet Money reports one of the reasons it has been such a long drama is that a debt crisis has never been solved like this before.
Sure, countries have stiffed their creditors before, but actually Greece hasn't yet. That's why this has been such an agonizing process.
The model usually is that you wait for a country to blow up and then you do the cleanup.
This is Hans Humes, president of Greylock Capital, a hedge fund. He loaned Greece some money, and he's been negotiating with the Greeks for months on behalf of some of the people who lent Greece money.
If you assembled everybody that Greece owes money to, you kind of have to get a really, really big haul.
And because there's so many people, it's been a really complicated negotiation. But it's more than that.
This could be a really good model of recognizing a situation for what it is and heading it off before it becomes really catastrophic. But yeah, this is pretty uncharted territory.
Usually it's like this. Countries default on their loans. Then we talk. But this is the European Union. Countries inside the EU are not supposed to go broke. Europe is supposed to take care of its own. If they let Greece go down, default on its loans, stiff its creditors, then other Eurozone countries could get cut off from lending. So European leaders have gotten people like Hans to agree to take some serious losses. In Greece, it already feels catastrophic. I reached fund manager Timos Melissaris in Athens.
Right now, the economy, it's dead.
What do you mean the economy is dead?
It's like what happened to the States during the 30s. Even the supermarkets are down in sales, gasoline, everything.
The Greek politicians came up with a budget they thought would please the European leaders, who have made a second round of loans conditional upon an extremely austere budget. That austere budget won't help Greece grow its economy. And a little economic growth could go a long way towards helping Greece actually pay people back. Zoe Chase, NPR News, New York.
Next, we meet a playwright who has been thinking about one of the more dramatic stories in Africa in the 19th century. It was the white colonization of the country known for a time as Rhodesia. The playwright turned that history into a visceral new play now on stage in Princeton, New Jersey. After its run there, it heads to Chicago. Whether or not you're ever able to see The Convert, it's worth learning the story of the playwright. Here's Jeff London.
Playwright Denai Gurira sometimes refers to herself as Zimerican. While she was born in Iowa, she spent most of her childhood in her parents' home city, Harare, Zimbabwe. It's where her new play is set.
I grew up there from age 5 to 19. I'm back there every year. But I feel like there are things that I had to dig out through this process of creating this play that for some reason I wasn't exposed to a lot, just in terms of how, you know, I was educated. I was educated very much in a neo-colonial way, honestly.
Gurira says The Convert is the first play in a series she hopes to write about Zimbabwe through the eyes of the people whose lives were transformed by colonialism.
I was thinking one day and I was like, I want to make a play that's sort of like an adaptation of Pygmalion about Zimbabwe, because I just feel like there's so many parallel themes. And that's really where it was born from. And then it just took its own route.
In Pygmalion, Henry Higgins takes a poor flower girl named Eliza Doolittle and teaches her to speak the king's English. In The Convert, a young woman from the Shona tribe, Jekasai, runs away from an arranged marriage and is taken under the wing of a black Catholic missionary named Chilford.
Well, the first of things that must be done is that name must be changed. You need a name that expresses a Christian faith. Mary, mother of Jesus, is the most blessed name. But I just need another girl this afternoon. There's Ruth. But I hate names of monosyllables. So, Esther!
Gurira uses her own family history in the play. Her great-great-aunt became a nun, fleeing a forced betrothal. Director Emily Mann says this was a common occurrence in Rhodesia in the late 19th century, when the play is set.
There were many, many women who ran to the church. Some of them became nuns, some of them became teachers, basically so that they could be free. You know, women were often fleeing being sold off in a way, or being given away without their own permission to a man to be, you know, could be, as in this play, the 10th wife of an old man.
And Jekasai, or Esther as she's christened, adapts quickly to her new situation. Pascal Armand plays the teenage girl.
She's learned a whole new language. She's learned about a whole new religion, which she has put complete and utter faith in, like puts her life into this new way of thinking and new way of believing.
Leading her in this transformation is Chilford, who has renounced his own family and tribal traditions. And while his deepest desire is to become a priest, few black Africans were ordained in those days. He's a decent and well-meaning man, playwright Denai Gurira says, but...
He's a casualty, one could say, of the issue of colonization, in the sense that he really drinks all the Kool-Aid, like every last drop of it, really embracing hook, line, sinker, the idea that a Christian God is very intertwined with a white man.
The gap between doctrine and reality, black and white, causes the characters to be twisted like pretzels. For instance, Chilford is furious at Esther for correcting a white priest in church. But actress Pascal Armand says the village girl doesn't understand why she has to defer.
I have no understanding of racism. This is my first introduction to that term, to that ideology that I now have to deal with and be subservient to, and no.
You told me that we must never be in the tolerance of a misquoting of the Bible in our presence.
Yes,
you told me that under that circumstance we must be quick to correct, to be of certainty that the Lord's word is never in distortion. That is what I am in belief that I did.
Yes, but not to Father Bart.
May I be asking why?
Why? Is it not in the obvious? He is a white.
He is?
So you may never correct him.
While white characters are discussed on stage, the convert is told entirely from the black viewpoint. In an early draft of the play, Guerrera says she attempted to write a scene with Chilford's white mentor.
I tried to put him on the stage. And I was like, no, it's going to be an absolute caricature. I'm not going to be able. And it didn't make sense. It just didn't make sense. I was like, this is going to be the play from the colonized perspective.
The tensions in the society erupt, and in the second act, the audience finds out that Chilford's mentor has been killed. And as the convert unfolds in highly intense fashion over the course of 3 hours, it becomes clear that, unlike Shaw's Pygmalion, this is a tragedy. Blood will be spilled. Lives will be ruined. Director Emily Mann.
You begin to understand from the colonized what colonialism really is. And because Denai is too smart to make it one person's right and one person's wrong, or black and white in any way, she's so interested in gray areas. She's so interested in how messy human beings really are.
Things are not good, brother.
What happened to your head, man? Have a seat, man.
The rebellion, it has spread. It is now certain to us here. In Mashona land.
Mashona? Never! They're too docile. That cannot be of truth.
It is. The first family was already slaughtered.
Even though The Convert is set in the late 19th century, Denai Guerrera thinks it has relevance to the problems of contemporary Africa.
What dynamics of our traditions do we retain, and what are we retaining only because we got colonized? And so there was this huge, you know, stop gap that happened in terms of how we were taken over and we were not able to evolve in our own way, in our own time.
The Convert finishes its run in Princeton this Sunday. It then moves on to the Goodman Theater in Chicago and the Center Theater Group in Los Angeles. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London.
You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine from Illinois Public Media. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director. A few times a year, we come to you to ask for your financial support. And this is one of those times. It is our midwinter fund drive. And we have an added incentive for you that we hope we'll encourage you to go to a phone and give us a call at 217-244-9455. For every pledge of financial support WILL receives today, Common Ground Food Co-op will donate the cost of 8 meals to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. So please take this opportunity to make your pledge twice as powerful, supporting your local public radio station and helping fight hunger here in Central Illinois. The number to call, 217-244-9455, 244-WILL. Or you can make your contribution online at willpledge.org. Thank you.
WILL programs are made possible by the Champaign Park District, presenting The Capitol Steps at the Virginia Theater on Saturday, February 18th at 8 p.m. A regular on NPR, The Capitol Steps songs and skits satirize Washington and the world inside the Beltway. Ticket information is available at 356-9063.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 10th of February, 2012. It's the birthday of the novelist Mary McGarry Morris, born in Meriden, Connecticut, 1943, author of Songs in Ordinary Time, the playwright and poet Bertolt Brecht, born in Augsburg, Germany, 1898. Bertolt Brecht, a Marxist who regarded his plays as social experiments, did not want the audience to become emotionally involved with the story, rather to acknowledge the stage as a stage and the actors as actors and not as real people. With Hitler's rise to power in 1933, Brecht left Germany, moved to Denmark, then Sweden, Finland, journeyed across Russia, settled in Hollywood in 1941, as in Germany his books were burned and his citizenship was withdrawn. And it's the birthday of the Norwegian journalist Astni Sejersted, born in Oslo, 1970, best known for The Bookseller of Kabul, which came out in 2003, was a big bestseller. Astny Seierstad, who after college in Norway went to China to study Chinese, to Berlin to learn German, Moscow to work for a news agency, Belgrade to live in an artist's colony, also lived in Mexico, France, Italy. She became fluent in five languages and okay, as she puts it, in four more. She pretended to be a journalist so that she could interview an opposition leader in Russia in the early 90s, and then decided to become a journalist. She covered Russia's war on Chechnya, and after 9/11, she spent weeks in rural parts of Afghanistan with the commandos of the Northern Alliance, traveling in military vehicles, sleeping on stone floors and in mud huts. She rode into Kabul with the Northern Alliance in November 2001 and found a bookstore